want you to picture a scenario for a second. It is, let's say 2 a.m.
Oh, we've all been there.
Right. You are wide awake, tossing and turning, and you just can't quiet your mind. So you reach over to the nightstand, grab the remote, and you turn on the television.
Just looking for some background noise, usually.
Exactly. And the screen flickers to life in this dark room, and suddenly you are bathed in that mesmerizing, almost hypnotic glow of late night TV. And right there on the screen, looking you dead in the eye with like an impossible amount of energy, is an incredibly charismatic host pitching a sparkling cubic zirconia ring.
Or, you know, they are standing in a brightly lit kitchen studio demonstrating this countertop blender that looks like it could successfully pulverize a solid concrete cinder block.
Yes. And even if you live in a tiny apartment, you rarely cook, and you have literally zero need for an industrial-grade blender, you just cannot look away.
It's totally captivating.
It really is. It's this shared nostalgic experience so many of us have. But behind that warm, folksy late-night companionship was an undeniably brilliant, highly optimized retail machine. And in today's deep dive, we are looking at what happens when that exact machine hits a brick wall at full speed.
Which brings us to the sudden and frankly genuinely shocking April 2026 Chapter 11 bankruptcy of QVC Group, which is the parent company of both QVC and HSN.
Right. To figure out how a legendary retail giant wound up suffocating under $6.6 billion in debt, we are opening up a huge stack of recent SEC filings and a really detailed document we looked at to trace the exact anatomy of this collapse.
And I think it's important to note right up front, the underlying narrative in these documents isn't just a story about a failing corporate balance sheet.
No, not at all.
It is actually this intricate masterclass in how a legacy media empire can inadvertently lay the very groundwork for its own demise, basically by training the next generation of digital influencers.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to understand the future of this company, we really have to look at the immediate legal and financial hemorrhage happening right now. And the sheer scale of the problem is just staggering.
$6.6 billion in debt.
Yeah. That is a boulder you simply cannot push up a hill when your revenues are consistently shrinking year over year.
Which is exactly what triggered their prepackaged Chapter 11 filing down in Texas on April 16th of 2026.
Wait, explain the prepackaged part for a second.
Sure. So the key mechanism there is that word, prepackaged. Before they even walk through the courtroom doors, they had already negotiated a restructuring support agreement. Or an RSA.
With your major lenders, right.
Exactly. They essentially convinced the lenders to agree to take a financial haircut before the judge ever really got involved.
Okay, so they are currently operating under a legal status known as a debtor in possession.
Right, and that specific status is crucial. It allows them to keep the broadcast lights on, continue paying their immediate vendors, and importantly, it keeps their international operations entirely ring-fenced and protected from the U.S. bankruptcy proceedings.
Got it. So the ultimate goal of this Texas courtroom maneuver is to forcefully slash that $6.6 billion debt down to roughly $1.3 billion.
Yes. And they are attempting to execute this incredibly complex financial surgery in a terrifyingly short 90-day sprint.
90 days. I mean, for a company that deals in physical inventory, gigantic warehouses, and global logistics, 90 days is just wildly fast.
It is.
And they are running on absolute fumes to get there. The research shows they practically maxed out their $3.25 billion revolving credit line.
Yeah, they only have about $200 million in accessible liquidity left.
Which, I mean, $200 million sounds like a lot of money to you and me.
Oh, sure. But for an operation of this scale, it is barely enough to cover basic operating expenses during a restructuring. I mean, they have zero margin for error right now.
Now, I do have to bring something up, because if you've been looking at financial portals recently, you've probably seen charts claiming that QVC's stock fell from over $900 a share all the way down to under a buck.
Right. But looking at the historical data, that $900 figure doesn't actually seem to reflect the lived reality of a typical shareholder.
No, not at all. Those charts are highly misleading to retail investors. The $900 price is basically an illusion created by how financial algorithms read historical stock data without proper context.
So how does that happen?
Think of it like slicing a pizza. That $900 price assumes you own the entire original uncut pizza from decades ago. But over the years, QVC's parent entities executed these complex corporate spin-offs and tracking stock adjustments.
So they were effectively handing out slices of that pizza to form other independent companies.
Exactly. The standard stock charts often just forget to adjust for the slices that were taken away, which artificially inflates the historical price on the graph.
The real apples-to-apples peak valuation for the modern entity was around $30 a share back in February 2015.
Okay, $30. But make no mistake, watching a stock bleed from $30 down to roughly 79 cents before bouncing slightly to $2.26 on the news of the restructuring agreement, that is still an event of catastrophic wealth destruction.
Oh, totally.
And it's not just the stock price that got destroyed. I was looking at the SEC filings, and they recorded this devastating trade name impairment. It was $930 million for the QVC name alone.
And $578 million for HSN.
Right. To me, that is like finding out a vintage Rolex you insured for $1 million is suddenly worth 50 bucks simply because no one wears watches anymore. I mean, did the literal letters QVC just lose their cultural magic?
Well, an impairment charge is a company legally admitting to the SEC that the cultural cachet of their brand name, like the identity itself, will no longer generate the future cash flow they once confidently projected. Yeah, they are officially writing down the value of their own reputation.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. Because to understand how a company loses a multi-billion dollar empire, we have to look at how bizarrely brilliant their rise actually was.
Because they weren't always a cable behemoth.
No. The documents we looked at trace their origins way back to 1977 on a local AM radio station in Clearwater, Florida.
Yeah, they were literally just selling overstock merchandise over the radio. And the founders looked at the engagement and realized, hey, if this concept works through audio alone, the conversion rates would completely skyrocket if we could actually show the audience the product.
Which is so intuitive when you think about it.
Right. And that realization birthed the Home Shopping Network, or HSN. But the leap to television wasn't a straight line to cable dominance. In the late 1990s, HSN was actually broadcasting on 12 USA broadcasting stations.
Spearheaded by media mogul Barry Diller.
Exactly. Diller had already created the Fox network a decade prior, and the research notes he was trying to capture lightning in a bottle a second time. He wanted to create a localized fifth broadcast network.
But my question is, why focus on physical over-the-air broadcast channels when cable television was booming? People already had cable.
Well, Diller's strategy was actually rooted in audience segmentation. Viewers could already find HSN on their cable dial. So Diller saw those over-the-air broadcast channels as incredibly valuable real estate, but only if they served their specific communities with localized programming and regional sports.
Oh, so he was intentionally trying to break away from the home shopping model on those specific broadcast channels.
Right. He wanted to reserve them for high-value community engagement.
Okay, that makes sense. And the flagship station for this grand experiment was based down in South Florida. The call letters were WAMI, which literally stood for We Are Miami.
But locals actually just called it Whammy.
Whammy, right.
Yeah.
It featured locally produced entertainment. The surreal part is they had a daily news program called The Times. They leaned fully into the local flavor, too.
Whammy and that whole localized network concept ended up closing down.
And the mechanism behind that failure is fascinating.
Yeah, the overhead of local programming simply crushed their margins.
But while Diller's HSN was tangled up in these really expensive broadcast experiments, John Malone's Liberty Media was executing a totally different, vastly more efficient strategy with QVC.
Right, because Malone was an infrastructure guy. He understood the mechanics of cable bandwidth better than anyone else in the industry.
So instead of spending money trying to build an expensive community through local content, QVC just ruthlessly bought up their competition.
They acquired the Fashion Channel, CVN, and the JCPenney Shopping Channel.
But they didn't actually care about the brand loyalty of the JCPenney Shopping Channel, did they?
No, not at all. They just wanted the literal shelf space. In the early days of cable, there were a very limited number of channels available on the physical copper wire running into your house.
So by buying their competitors, QVC was buying the physical bandwidth.
Exactly. They effectively boxed out any potential competition from reaching the living room, creating an impenetrable duopoly with HSN.
They secured a total monopoly on the distribution pipe. It makes me think of building a medieval fortress. You build these incredibly high stone walls, lock the iron gates, and you own the only toll road leading to the castle.
That's a great analogy.
If anyone wants to sell a retail product to the American public on television, they have no choice but to pay your toll. But that fortress model relies entirely on a captive audience.
Right.
If half your town suddenly packs up and moves away, your toll road is completely worthless. And the cord-cutting data in the research shows exactly that migration. The internet didn't bother attacking the walls of the fortress. It just invented the airplane and flew right over them.
The toll road became fundamentally irrelevant. I mean, in the early 2010s, cable television penetration was at roughly 100 million households.
That represented about 87% of all homes in the United States.
Yeah, it was a built-in storefront window where millions of people were casually walking past your shop every single day. But by 2025, that penetration had plummeted to around 50%.
Half the storefront windows boarded up. And the core economics explain exactly why. The document we looked at shows average cable bills ballooned to $147 a month, while a Netflix subscription was sitting at just $15.
The delivery mechanism was simply too expensive for the consumer.
So to survive that immense loss of their captive audience, QVC basically had to start selling the furniture to pay the mortgage.
And that financial diet took the form of Project Athens, which was a severe corporate restructuring effort. They heavily hollowed out their physical footprint.
Yeah, in 2025, they completely closed down the sprawling HSN campus in St. Petersburg, Florida, and consolidated operations all the way up to Pennsylvania just to save on overhead.
The SEC filings also detail these incredibly aggressive sale-leaseback deals over in Europe.
Oh, right. They sold off their key properties in Germany and the UK, netted $182 million in cash, and then immediately signed contracts to lease those exact same buildings back from the new owners.
Which is pretty risky.
To me, that seems like a highly dangerous long-term strategy. You are artificially inflating your short-term liquidity, but you are permanently raising your fixed operating costs because now you have to pay rent forever.
Well, it is a classic desperate liquidity maneuver. You are functionally trading your long-term viability for immediate survival. You swap a bondholder for a landlord.
Yeah.
It does not fix the underlying structural issues of the business. It just buys you a few more months of oxygen to figure out a pivot.
Speaking of immediate survival, there is a detail in the filings about an actual physical disaster that ironically became a financial lifeline.
Oh, the fire.
Yes. In 2021, their enormous Rocky Mount Fulfillment Center in North Carolina caught fire and burned down. Obviously, a total tragedy for their physical logistics and the local employees, but the financial payout acted as corporate life support.
They ultimately received $280 million in insurance payouts.
And then turned around and sold the charred land itself for another $19 million.
It perfectly highlights just how tight their liquidity had become, you know? When an insurance payout on a destroyed physical asset is functionally sustaining the broader corporate balance sheet.
Okay, so the cable pipe is dying, the real estate is being stripped down, and we are living in a heavily inflationary economy.
Yeah, money is tight everywhere.
How are the remaining customers even paying for these impulse buys? I mean, modern shoppers are totally addicted to buy now, pay later apps like Klarna or Affirm. How does QVC's older EasyPay system even compete with slick Silicon Valley fintech?
This is where their legacy status actually provides a really sharp regulatory advantage.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Recently, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB, issued heavy new regulations treating modern buy now, pay later apps fundamentally like credit cards.
Right, which comes with strict refund rights, fee limits, heavy compliance costs.
Because those modern apps act like a revolving digital account. But QVC's EasyPay system relies on a structural loophole.
What's the loophole?
EasyPay is a one-time transaction tied strictly to a specific physical item. You buy a vacuum, you pay it off in 5 installments, and once the vacuum is paid for, the transaction is permanently closed.
It does not create a centralized revolving line of digital credit.
Exactly. Therefore, QVC completely sidesteps the heavy new CFPB regulations that are currently battering their Silicon Valley competitors.
Wow. Okay, so what does this all mean? We've talked about the debt, the real estate sell-offs, the payment loopholes. But the common lazy narrative in the financial press is simply that e-commerce killed QVC.
Yeah, you see that headline everywhere.
And I really have to push back on that framing. Because when you look closely at the history, QVC basically invented modern e-commerce. They invented the concept of live, interactive, remote selling.
And what's fascinating here is that you've just hit on the core tragedy of this entire story.
Hmm.
QVC literally trained the next generation of digital influencers.
Yeah.
They established the foundational blueprint for modern digital commerce. Think about the intricate psychology of the sale they perfected over decades.
Right. They pioneered the charismatic host building a deep parasocial relationship with the viewer through the screen.
They introduced the ticking countdown clock to create manufactured urgency.
They developed the live inventory graphics, showing exactly how many items are left in stock in real time, just to push the viewer off the fence.
They engineered the exact dopamine loop that every single TikTok creator and Amazon Live host uses today. So they did not lose the concept of live selling.
The concept itself is more popular and profitable than ever before in human history.
Exactly. They just lost control of the delivery mechanism.
Linear television forced 1 million people to sit in their living rooms and watch a blender pitch at 2 p.m., regardless of whether they actually wanted or needed a blender.
It was incredibly inefficient.
Yeah.
But the algorithms of TikTok, Instagram, and YouTube bypassed that entirely. They deliver a hyper-personalized, highly optimized blender pitch directly to the 1,000 specific people who are mathematically most likely to buy it exactly at the moment they are scrolling.
Which brings us to their 90-day survival plan. Realizing they definitively lost the algorithmic distribution race, QVC's final pivot is to desperately try and beat the internet at its own game.
Internally, they call it the Win Growth Strategy. They executed a corporate rebrand back to QVC Group, and their explicit mission now is to become a live social shopping company.
So they are abandoning their identity as a traditional cable broadcaster.
Completely.
And according to a document we looked at, they are pushing incredibly hard into the streaming ecosystem. They are launching on Roku, Hulu, YouTube TV.
Yeah, they report that their dedicated streaming apps, QVC Plus and HSN Plus, says now boast 1.5 million monthly active users.
And their streaming sales actually grew by 19%.
And crucially, they claim to have gained 1 million entirely new U.S. customers through their integration with TikTok Shop.
Okay. I have to challenge the actual value of that specific metric, though. Gaining a million new customers on TikTok sounds fantastic in a corporate press release to appease nervous lenders. But what is the actual unit economic quality of those conversions?
That is the million-dollar question.
Right. A traditional QVC cable viewer was buying high-margin electronics, expensive cookware, and fine jewelry. A million Gen Z users on TikTok might just be buying a $3 lip gloss, triggering a positive metric for the algorithm, and then never returning. If a million people buy a $3 lip gloss, that's $3 million in gross revenue. That doesn't even make a dent in the interest payments on $6.6 billion in debt.
Yeah.
Can a high volume of cheap impulse buys actually fix a structural crater in the balance sheet?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, your skepticism regarding the unit economics is highly warranted.
Thank you.
The profit margins on a TikTok impulse buy are undeniably lower than a traditional QVC jewelry haul. The customer acquisition cost versus the lifetime value of a TikTok user is entirely unproven for them.
Right.
However, you have to look at the overall trajectory of the sinking ship. For the first time in 4 years, QVC actually stopped the bleeding and grew their active customer file.
Good there, sir.
They are no longer just broadcasting a high-powered signal into an increasingly empty room. They recognize the living room is gone, and they are actively scrambling to meet the modern consumer exactly where they are.
Which is at the very bottom of a personalized smartphone scroll. It really makes you think about your own daily habits. The next time you are mindlessly scrolling on your phone and you suddenly get pulled into a live product pitch by an influencer, maybe for a gadget or a skincare routine you didn't even know existed 5 minutes ago, I want you to remember this story.
Because the magic trick of the sale, yeah. You know, the engineered psychology, the ticking clock, the manufactured urgency.
It is exactly the same trick that was perfected in a television studio decades ago. Only the screen has changed.
And this raises an important question, one that every single tech executive in Silicon Valley should be asking themselves right now.
Oh.
Is the absolute titans of the American living room, the very pioneers of the influencer business model, could be entirely bypassed and bankrupted by the exact consumer behaviors they invented?
Wow, yeah.
What current technological giant like Google or Meta is inadvertently training its own replacements right now without even realizing it?
That is a fascinating thought. No one's technological fortress is truly impenetrable if you just give the next generation enough time to figure out how to build an airplane. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. The next time you catch that late-night television glow, you will know exactly what kind of machine is operating behind the screen.